Please be warned that this program contains mature subject matter and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
And look what it did. I will be in fear my whole life.
You're listening to My Aryan Princess from the Dallas Morning News, written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. I'm Christopher Wynn. Chapter 7, Whispers in the Windstorm.
The voices enunciate every fear. They are relentless in Carol's head, a damning drumbeat of shame. They know every icky interlude in her drug-enslaved life. The truck stop bathrooms, the sickening smell of pine cleaner and stale urine, the grimy fingernails and grunts and flickering fluorescent lights. The voices remember. They remember the enveloping warmth of heroin hitting the bloodstream, the itchiness, the sense of sinking into a feather pillow. They remember the matter-of-fact voice of the ABT general who promised torture before death. The stern instructions of a Homeland Security agent who offered government protection, her dad's offhand declaration, "You'll never get married." Carol Blevins is 38 years old now, unemployed and cut adrift. She's living alone for the first time in her life, in a ground floor apartment that backs up to a dirt courtyard with broken playground equipment. She lives on a $737 disability check and charity from her dad. Her rent is $677. "If I look at my life from the outside," she said, "I feel pretty shitty." Carol is the only confidential informant who testified against the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas in open court, an act of betrayal gang members say is a death sentence. But it's unclear whether the family can deliver on a hit ordered by ABT General James Skits Samsel, Carol's main mark and the crown jewel of the six-year investigation. Federal agents said the Brotherhood is in complete chaos. Press releases and a confidential report obtained by the Dallas Morning News show that more than 950 confirmed and suspected members of the white supremacist gang have been sentenced to prison since January 2013, when Carol's spy work ended. Her intel led to 13 convictions and contributed to at least 16 others, according to state and federal law enforcement officials. They said her work almost certainly touched dozens of other cases, but the way information is shared among agencies makes it impossible to know for sure. Carol takes little comfort in knowing the Brotherhood is weak and disorganized. She's convinced her honesty on the stand and duplicity during the arrest of Skits make her one of the gang's top targets. Some nights, terrified as she walks through an apartment complex parking lot, her emotions bubble with regret and self-pity. Other nights, high on meth and trying to impress, she'll tell anyone who will listen about her history with the ABT and feds. "I'm hiding in plain sight," she bragged last October, riding in the front seat of a drug dealer's white BMW. Minutes later, skin ashen and eyelids droopy, after taking a swig of liquid ecstasy, she stood in the kitchen of his rental house and considered the question, would she do it again? She talked herself into an answer. "I wouldn't be scared all the time," Carol said. "I still probably would have been a drug addict, but now at least I've done something. If I died tomorrow, at least I did something."
I decided to do heroin. I decided to start doing heroin, and it just kind of all fell off, fell apart.
Carol's parents say drugs are more likely than the Aryan Brotherhood to kill their daughter. "She's going to end up in jail or dead," said her mother, 74-year-old Sandra Blevins. "That's what the probation officer said years ago. When they start so young, they almost never come back." Doctors agree. Carol's early drug abuse, cocaine at 12 years old and heroin dependence by 15, almost certainly changed her brain chemistry. When overstimulated, the body revs up production of some hormones and throttles down others, a chemical recalibration that alters the way addicts think about their basic needs. Drugs light up the area of the brain that is really key to our success as a species, finding a mate, forming a tribe, getting food and shelter, said Brian Adenoff, a psychiatry professor who studies adolescent addiction at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Once the reward center is hijacked, we start thinking in order to survive, we don't need food and shelter. We need drugs. Carol failed her first rehab program at 17 and hasn't really tried it one since. Last fall, waves of irritation rolled off Sandra Blevins as she sat on a wooden bench outside a McKinney courtroom. Carol was convicted of assaulting her dad, the second time in less than 3 years. "He has done everything in the world for her," Sandra said, "and she still yells at him and calls him terrible names." Sandra fought to save Carol for a decade. She called probation officers on her lunch hour and sat through court-mandated parenting classes. When she let go, her husband, Ike, took over. The stress and expense have nearly cost them their marriage. Over 2 decades, Ike says, he spent most of his $50,000 retirement on Carol's doctors, lawyers, and prescriptions. He maxed out his last 2 credit cards in March, a combined balance of $28,500. "He's not letting her hit bottom," Sandra said, peeved. "I don't know when he's going to give up. When he's dead, maybe."
I'm the one that screwed up. It's not their fault that I did drugs and nearly killed myself. It's not their fault. It's not their fault I was screwed up on painkillers showing up to probation. You know, it's not their fault I did that.
Ike and Sandra were born smart but poor. After surviving childhood polio and graduating from a small college in Oklahoma, they moved to North Texas and bootstrapped an all-American, middle-class life. Ike says he and his wife gave their kids everything they didn't have growing up, but failed to give Carol what they did have, a work ethic, the knot-in-your-gut knowledge that if you don't get after it, you'll go without. "That's my fault," said 74-year-old Ike, who sleeps with an oxygen clip in his nose and mows his own grass. "I've never actually told her no." Last year, wearing blue suspenders and black sneakers, he asked a Collin County judge for help. Ike testified his daughter needed long-term inpatient treatment for mental illness and addiction. "But you can't pay for it, and Carol can't pay for it," challenged his daughter's attorney, Megan Miller. "So you want the state of Texas to pay for it, is that right?" Ike paused and cleared his throat. "As much as I dislike welfare," he said, "I guess I would swallow my pride and say yes." Minutes later, outside the courthouse, the question still stung. "I have worked my whole life," he said, leaning on an aluminum walker, arms trembling. "I just don't understand people who don't want to do well and do for themselves." Carol walked up and pushed a red spiral notebook toward her dad. Ike released his grip on his walker and with a liver-spotted right hand took what his daughter was handing out. Carol fired up a cigarette.
We went after all the generals, and there were 5 generals within the ABT.
It was the first time in law enforcement history that the RICO had been used to take down the entire leadership of a prison gang that had a nationwide presence.
We also indicted a number of majors and captains and essentially all leaders within this organization.
I believe that their command and control capabilities have been severely diminished.
We had 73 indictments. Of those 73 indictments, 100% were convicted.
It's non-existent on the streets. I mean, you have a few that have tried to step up and step into, but there's nothing. I mean, the head's cut off.
Ike says his daughter's work as a confidential informant was selfish and reckless and put his family in danger. "But if it wasn't for that," he said, "I could be really proud of Carol because she did what was right. Her method and motivation may not have been pure, but she did what she had to do." Ike is a country boy at heart, more John Wayne than Elvis Presley. And in the way of the Old West, he said sometimes it's hard to tell the good guys from the bad, but right and wrong are usually clear. He said the feds used Carol. They were paying her to be an informant, and she screwed up, and they dropped her like a hot potato, Ike said. But when it came time for Carol to testify at trial, they were all buddy-buddy again, and I didn't appreciate that. Carol usually casts herself as a victim when she tells her story. But in more than 100 hours of interviews over 17 months, high and sober, in and out of jail, from West Texas to Colorado, she accepts blame for one thing, her overdose in Denver. She will not criticize the Fed's decision to stuff money in a junkie's hand and hope for the best. "I don't think they set me up to fail," she said. "They did what they could do for me. All they could do is throw me out there and hope that I could make it." Carol's four handlers were among 15 winners of the U.S. Attorney General's Award for Distinguished Service in October 2015, the Justice Department's second highest honor. The night of the awards banquet in Washington, D.C., Carol pecked on a cracked cell phone screen in her apartment. She sat in the corner of a brown velour couch, a just shy of 6-foot scrap pile of bony knees and pink knuckles. An agent sent a text message. Carol read a piece of it aloud. "This wouldn't have happened without you, CC. Crazy Carol." She smiled but did not look up. "Because of her loyalty to the U.S. government, she sacrificed any semblance of a normal life," he said later. "How do you repay that?" In many ways, Carol's life is a modern-day Babylon story, a cautionary tale of racist idolatry and drug lust and self-destruction. But one federal agent said he also sees it as a parable. A there but for the grace of God go I lesson that teaches a moral truth. Judge and be judged. "She's tattered and torn," he said, "but read further into the book, look closer into the pages, and you'll actually see substance, some sort of beauty, and a righteousness in her trying to do the right thing." Carol craves the approval of government officials, and during the high drama days of the investigation, she got it, no matter how high or hysterical. Today, they screen her calls. Last fall, stoned on meth, she heard a Homeland Security agent speak through the wall of her apartment. "I tried to respect you, and I'll continue to try to respect you," he said, "but I have no respect for you." Carol knows the voices in her head are her own, self-hate and regret and fear. But faint and far away, there's another voice. It remembers a little girl sitting on her daddy's lap, pure and full of promise, keying the mic of an old ham radio, searching for a connection. CQ, CQ, CQ. And it clings to the hope a contemptible woman can be redeemed by an act of courage. "I'm a good person, but people don't see that," Carol said. "People think my past is who I am, but my past made me who I am."
I'd like to be married and, you know, have a dog and, you know, the house. And anything can happen.
When Carol was a kid, Ike always told her she came from a long line of horse thieves and bootleggers. He meant it as a reassuring message. There's a twig of truth in the story. A branch of a branch in the Blevins family tree runs back to outlaws in England. But that's not why he made the joke or refrain in his daughter's childhood. He wanted Carol to feel connected to her people, good or bad, famous or infamous, because the world can be cold and there's warmth in family. "I hoped she'd be proud of my heritage," he said, "and her heritage." But for whatever reason, there was always a desperation about Carol, a jagged, insecure hole, and no matter how fast Ike and his wife shoveled in love, they couldn't fill it up. "That's why she got mixed up with drugs," he said, and the ABT and feds. She was the perfect kid until she started doing heroin, Ike said. She used to actually like me. Carol expresses no regret about the relationship and rarely offers an apology. I love my dad. He does things for me, she said. But he's a fucking prick. Carol says Ike's right about one thing. She's been lonely most of her life. Until recent years, her extended family gathered at her aunt's house in Plano for Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, sharing covered dishes and common history. But after she got hooked on heroin at 15, Carol refused to go. I was embarrassed, she said. I wasn't going to go over there and have my cousin and his wife keep their kids away because they thought I was going to lose it. She's still isolated by addiction. After 25 years, she knows no other existence. Carol dreams of the banal life of a housewife, a fairy tale of domestic bliss, featuring an Aryan princess and her adoring prince. In an unguarded moment, eyes pleading, she launched into a sad soliloquy. I'm looking for somewhere I belong, but that will never happen because I don't belong anywhere. I want to get married. I want to have somebody. I want to get old with somebody. I want to have somebody and not have to pretend. Carol's words tumbled one over another. I want to be normal. Maybe not normal, but close to normal, she said. I want to go home. Several months ago, doctors increased the dose of one of her prescriptions, Tramadol, a mild narcotic, from 60 to 90 pills a month. Taken at once, enough to commit suicide. About a week after Ike asked the judge to sentence his daughter to inpatient mental health and drug treatment, Carol smoked meth with associates of the ABT. She caught an Uber home from the hotel and persuaded a man to come over. Rough sex scratched her insecurities, which lurk just under the surface like a staph infection. Poisonous thoughts poured in. Carol's voices know the truth and every beguiling lie. They are whispers in the windstorm of her life, and they made her a promise that night. Death is the ultimate drug. She emptied 6 prescription bottles, 3 handfuls of pills, and washed them down with Diet Coke. Carol woke 2 days later on the floor, splitting headache, swelling over her right eye. Everything was fuzzy except the first question that flashed through her mind. Why am I here?
My Aryan Princess was written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. The audio version of My Aryan Princess was produced by Spoke Media in partnership with the Dallas Morning News. Our producers are Keith Reynolds and Christopher Wynn, that's me, with production assistance from Josh Kumler, Mark Moncrief, and Isaac Young. Our music was composed by Jason Reimer, and our show was mixed by Will Hensley. Visit dallasnews.com/ABT for direct downloads and links to our show in Apple Podcasts and other audio players. You'll also find exclusive DMN subscription offers at dallasnews.com/listen. Thanks for listening.